This is a recording of Marie Kay from Burbank, California, the speaker at the Longtimers meeting, taped at the 5th Annual Indian Wells Valley AA Roundup in Ridgecrest, California, on Saturday, April 25th, 1992, in observance with the 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level. Please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
The leader to take a couple minutes to identify himself. Well, I'm going to pass on that because I need 3 hours. I want to take time right now, though, is there, for the newcomers, is there anyone here with a day or less? Any newcomers with a week or less? For us here today, that's the most important person here. And the day will come when he'll be sitting on this platform wondering where in the hell all the time went. It really goes. I am going to take a couple minutes, though, to not go into any long story or anything, but to tell you that I do qualify because I was a fallen-down drunk and I needed to do something. In some strange way, I was introduced to AA. And they were meeting at a church, and not being that religious, I frowned on going there for a long time. But I got so bad that finally I said, if they're going to throw me in the wash and wave the wands, why, I got to go through it sooner or later, and I walked through the doors of AA. And I didn't take. I'm like many others. I stayed for about 11 months, and then I went on a rip-roaring geographical cure for about 3 more years. Finally, when I walked through the doors, then I was ready, and I've been sober ever since. I thought for a while that hearing speakers all around the country and roundups and conventions and that every speaker I heard was a former Marine. And being a former Marine, I said, by God, they made drunks out of all of us. And I got to tell you a story about that. That in 1944, I was overseas, and I was in a guard detachment at a submarine base, and I did a 12-4 on the back gate. Well, before that, I was at a free port where booze was cheap. The only thing is, I didn't have enough money. My base pay, I went in my first 3 months, I was getting $22 a month. And then I got a big pay raise to $30, but I still couldn't afford to drink good whiskey. It was $1.10 a fifth. The CBs moved in, and I made them my buddies because they hid it down under the lumber and in the paint shop and that. So I got to drinking cheap Boca Chica rum. And I started carrying it, emptying my water, a night guard, and filling it full of rum. Well, in those days, Carmen Miranda was singing rum and Coca-Cola, and I thought that was the drink. So I was drinking that heavy. And I was on a 12-4 one night on the back gate, way out in the boonies, and I'm strapped there with a sawed-off shotgun, a 45, and a couple bandoliers hanging on. And there was a little red lantern hanging across the road there in the guard shack. And I was there for a while, and I heard the damnedest scream you ever heard in your life. And I jumped up, and I cocked that sawed-off shotgun and looked around, and wasn't a damn soul there. It was me. I was down, sitting down on an orange crate there, giving close-order drill to a colony of ants and giving them hell because they wouldn't fall in formation. So that's the last drink of Boca Chica rum I ever had. Then I started going to the good stuff, and progressively it got worse and worse. And being, I can't lie, I was hoping that I could tell a story here and lie a little bit, but I have family here. I have my sister-in-law visiting from Maryland, and she knows. Back in Maryland in them days, you couldn't go to bars, and that you had to go to state-controlled liquor stores. Well, when you did, on a weekend, they made damn sure they got enough that they never run out for the weekend. You could buy it by the quart and half a gallon, and they'd load it up. And we would go to dances there, and everything was a drunk. All my life, I never said anything about going and having a drink. It was always to go to get drunk. And in the service, back in them days as a young guy, if you lived to be 30 years old, you were old. And every liberty that you got to pitch was going to be your last, so you let it all hang out, and it was nothing but drink. And from that point on, up until I landed here in Ridgecrest where I got my sobriety, it took everything away from me. There's a sign on that, they ought to put on that bottle, a relief. If you first start out, it relieves you of your stress. It relieves you of your pain. And then pretty soon it relieves you of your wallet. It relieves you of your job. It relieves you of everything. And pretty soon it relieves you of your sanity. And that's exactly where I was. I was just in the early stages of snakes when I got here. And you talk about sitting on your hands and trembling. Several of them around here know. And I went through it. So with that, I'll shut my big mouth and introduce our speaker, Marie Kay.
I told you she was little.
My name is Marie Kay, and I'm a little alcoholic. A little short on one end. Thank you, Frank. I'll dance at your golden wedding, okay? First, I would like to thank Bob S. and Nancy and Frank and the committee for inviting me to share here. This is my first time in Ridgecrest. Beautiful. Wonderful hospitality. I think I'm going to come back. Now, I want to put all of you at ease. I talked at a convention a couple of years ago in Yosemite, and I had a stroke while talking. I didn't know I was having a stroke. Somebody recognized that I was. I come here today to speak to you, and I went to the Al-Anon lunch, took a bite of something, and broke my lower denture in two. But don't worry, let me do the worrying for the rest of the time. I know there's a message in that, I just don't know what it is yet, you know? I have been sober ever since I knowed how. That's been quite a while. I am the daughter of an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I knew he was drunk. My mother and I both knew that. And we hated him. God, we hated him. And he was a womanizer. And we hated that. I tried to kill my father twice. And might have succeeded had not my mother intervened. I never knew why. She hated him too, but she did. I tried to kill another girl who told a lie about me. I tried to kill her once by drowning her in the river. And I tried to kill her the second time in a toilet. So don't make me mad, because I'll get you one way or the other. You know, somebody my size should not do things like that. But that's the way I was. I became exactly what my father was. Now, I don't know what the female part of a womanizer is, but I'm a manizer. I have two husbands of my own and a whole lot of yours. And hard giving up some of those old habits, huh? But I have, so you can relax on that. You know, it's amazing. I recognized that my father was a drunk, but it took me such a long time to recognize that I was. I see the faults in others, and it takes me a long time to recognize that same thing in me. You know, I'm a fallen away Catholic. There are a number of us around. I started out in Fulfield School. Broke all the rules there that I could find to break. And we moved to a little town, population 500, and I got to go to what they called a central school. And boy, I found out how loose they were with their rules. And I started breaking all their rules. And now I have to live by rules. It's incredible. I don't like it all the time. But I find a certain peace of mind in realizing that the rules apply to me. I had my first drink when I was 10 years old. I was a skinny kid. I'm fat now, you may have noticed that. And the doctor suggested to my mother that perhaps if I was to have a little glass of home brew before my meals, that it might enhance my appetite. Well, now, neither my mother or I cared much about home brew, I'll tell you. We didn't like the smell of it, and I used to have to bottle it for my father. And I've been known to blow up a couple of batches of that stuff because I didn't like my job. And now I was going to have to drink it. And my mother gave me that little glass because the doctor said I had to have it. And it tasted as bad as it smelled, and I knew it would. And my keen little alcoholic mind said, how do I get out of this? And because my mother and I both hated drunks, I decided I'd have two glasses, and I'd get drunk and she'd take it away from me. And I did that one night. I had two glasses instead of one with the desired result, so I got drunk and fell in the flour barrel. And my mother said I didn't have to have that stuff anymore. And I stayed sober for 3 years. Never touched a drop for 3 years. And I went to a church dance one night. Me and my heartbreaker. He sang on the radio. And he belonged to our church. And I asked my mother if I could go to the church dance. And she said, of course, it's a church dance. You may go. So I went to the church dance. And it was in the fall of the year. And they had all the heaters going in. At an intermission, we all went outside. And, of course, all the adults were passing around a paper sack. I didn't know what was in that paper sack, but everybody said, oh, boy, is that good, and they'd go like that. I thought, I wonder what that is. Then I thought, oh, of course it's alcohol, because the town bootlegger was passing the sack around. So those adults said, why don't we give Marie a little sip of that? So we gave Marie a little sip of that. And God, that it was like lightning is what it was. And it hit from here down to here, and my eyes bugged out of my head. And I thought, what is that? I had to be sure, so I took another little sip, you know, to be sure. Well, what had happened had happened. And they took the bottle away from me. And we went back inside to finish the dance, and I said to my dancing partner, where did all these people come from? And he looked around and he said, well, it's the same people that were here before. I said, no, the crowd doubled. And he realized what had happened to me. I was drunk on that white lightning. And he decided he better take me home. And he took me home. And it was afraid of my father, because my father, everybody was afraid of my father. And he took me, we had a front door on one street and a back door on the other. So he took me to the back door, opened the kitchen door and pushed me in. Unfortunately, my mother's kitchen table was on casters, and we went sliding across that floor into the stove, and God, I was trying to be so quiet. And I was sleeping in winter quarters at that time, which was in the back of the house, and it was an enclosed stairway, and I tried to go up the stair and be quiet, and I knocked all the pans down, and oh, God, I had a terrible time. And I got into my room, and I'm getting undressed behind the heater, the wall pipe that went through the up through the bedroom that heated the room. And I got all my clothes off and I fell into the heater. And I thought, oh, damn, and I walked around and I waited for the bed to stop switching around and finally hit it and I went onto the bed. And that's all I remembered about that. And the next morning my mother called me to go to church and I didn't answer. And she called me again, I guess, and I didn't answer. And she came up the stairs to see what was wrong with me. And I was crossways on the bed with my head out the window. My head was covered with snow. And she pulled me in and rolled me over, and my body was one blister from here straight on down. And she said, "What happened?" And I said, "Mother, I took a swig out of a paper sack." And she said, "Who gave it to you?" And I told her, and it was the town bootlegger. And she knew what I'd had, and she said, "We can't tell your father." And we didn't tell my father. We covered up the blisters, and I went on with my life. And I didn't drink every day from then on. But I can tell you I drank at every opportunity. At every opportunity, and I can arrange opportunities. I don't know about you, but we alcoholics are pretty good at that. And I could arrange any time that I wanted to do something, I could arrange to do it. And my uncle died, and we moved back to the big city of Plattsburgh, New York. And I wound up drinking the East Coast. I drank up the East Coast from Canada through half of South America and back again. And I said, "I'm going out to the West Coast. I'll see how that goes." And I didn't get to drink up all of the West Coast. I got to drink up half of it. I got to drink up from the San Fernando Valley through Baja and back again, and on up to Santa Barbara and that area, and then I got sober. And you know, I saw the rest of the West Coast sober. It's beautiful. I wonder what the East Coast looks like sober. Amazing, isn't it? You know, I married my first husband, who was a non-drinker, one of those normsies, you know. I married him by accident. He came from old money, and I like old money. And he didn't drink very much. He was from Quito, Ecuador, but he was living in Miami at the time. And I thought he looked like a pretty good deal there. I was almost 24 years old in my hometown. They were telling me that I was going to be an old maid. Now, if they said bachelor girl, I'd have bought it, but old maid I didn't like. So I said, "It's almost time to get married." And I tried to teach that idiot how to drink and never could make it. Never could make it. In those days, I was spending my winters in 9 months in Florida, and I'd go home in the summertime. And they sent up some of those dollar a year men in the early 40s, and that's old money too. And I picked on one of those, and I thought, now I wonder, do I want that guy that doesn't know how to drink in Florida, or would I like this one? And this one gave me a blank check and told me to go back to Florida and make up my mind which one I wanted. Sounded like a hell of a deal to me. And I went back to Florida, and that guy didn't ask me to marry him. So I showed him the blank check, and I said, "You going to ask me to marry you, or am I going back and marry this rich guy?" And he said, "Will you marry me?" And I said, "Sure." And we went off to Fort Lauderdale, and got married. Surprised the family somewhat. And we got back, and I sent the blank check. I was even honest in those days. I sent the blank check back to the rich guy up north in Westchester County. And I stayed married to that person for 6 years. Most I ever got out of a marriage is 6 years. I don't know what there is about that, but that's it. I stayed married to that young man for 6 years. And I divorced him because he simply could not learn to drink like me, and he was tired of my drinking. You know, it's funny, when I was married to him, I got him a good job in South America. And I thought he'd go there and leave me to hell alone. I could have fun. Because I was doing that thing that my father did. I was cheating on that husband. But it didn't work. I had to go to South America with him. And in South America, I had to be good. I have never been good at being good. I am very good at being bad. I am very good at being bad. But it's wartime. And we're under contract. And I have to behave myself. And I don't know what happened down there. Except that São Paulo is very high at 7,000 feet. And something happened to my body. I swelled up to twice my normal size. And I got to break the contract and come back to the States. And part of doing that was I had to spend some time in Rio to get all the papers signed because I was breaking the contract. and I saw a good-looking man sitting in the lobby of that hotel. God, he was good-looking. Well, I got my eye on him because my husband's back in São Paulo and I'm in Rio. And I'm going to be there for several days, and I figure I might as well have a little fun and been good for a whole year. And I would have to start out in the morning and go with my guide that was getting me out of this contract. And this afternoon I had decided I'd had it with those people that don't start to live till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I came back for a drink because it was just what I needed. And there was that good-looking man. And he listened to my very best Portuguese. And he started to laugh, and he came over and he said, "I guess you're an American." I said, "Where'd you get that idea? Did my Portuguese get in the way?" And he said, "Yes." So he said, "Can I buy you a drink?" And I said, "Sure." And he sat down. And we chatted and lied to each other and had a lot of fun talking. And he said, "When is your husband going to get here?" And I said, "He's not. He's still in São Paulo." He said, "Well, I thought maybe you'd like to go to the embassy tonight." And I said, "I'd love to go to the embassy." He said, "I'll have to change clothes." And I said, "So will I." So I went to my room with two martinis and I changed clothes and took a bath, took a shower and changed clothes. And we were meeting in the lobby at 6 o'clock. And I came down the lobby and there was my handsome new fella in his whites, in his navy whites. God, he looked good and he got close to me. And all of a sudden I discovered something. There was a gold cross on his white uniform. And when he had introduced himself to me, I thought he had given me a nickname like Chappie. What he had said was Chaplain. And I don't know what to do now because I am a babbling idiot. I have not eaten all day. I have had more drinks than need be. And we are going to a party at the embassy and I can't even talk. I've just come unglued because I'm a Catholic, or call me a Catholic, and that's a priest that I've been yakking to all afternoon with designs on his body, of course. And we get to the embassy and he said, "Marie, just relax, Marie." He said, "Kathy will tell you all about me." And I got to the embassy and I met Kathy, who was a friend of his and worked at the embassy, and she said, "I'm Kathy." I said, "Good." I yanked her outside. I said, I was sitting on that. I did not know he was a Catholic priest. And she said, "Relax, Marie, you ought to hear his story." Sounded all right to me. Ladies were all looking. He was going around talking to all the ladies. And I won't tell you the whole story, but I was there for 3 or 4 days. And finally, I had finished everything I had to do to get out of there and get back to Miami. And I'm walking on the beach at 6 o'clock in the morning with the chaplain. And we're saying our goodbyes and whatnot, and I'm going away, and I get about 50 feet away from him, and he said, "Hey, Marie," and I turned around, and he's waving at me. He said, "Remember, Marie, there are no new sins." I thought, that's easy for you to say. That's easy for you to say. But I've never, never forgotten that. There are no new sins. If they are, I haven't heard of them yet, or I would have committed them, I'm sure. And I got back to the States. And I thought, good, I'm home now and I'll get rid of that husband. I'll keep him there in South America. And it's New Year's Eve and I'm at the country club. My mother-in-law had given us a membership to the country club. And I'm at the country club enjoying a dance with a Pan American pilot I'd picked up on the way home. And they're dancing away and a tap on my shoulder and I turned around and it's my husband. I thought, why did you come back so quick? My drinking is progressing along with this. And I'm doing things that I am not at all proud of. And I get rid of that husband, finally. And I send him back to South America where he belongs. And I stay single for 6 years. And I drink a lot in those 6 years. And I'm living in a house that's full of college kids. And I got a lot of headaches and I got a lot of hangovers and I got a good job and I'm the boss. I'm now in the insurance business. I was in hotel business and I was in construction business and now I'm in insurance business. And I'm the boss. And sometimes I can't show up for work because I have such a headache. I tell the boss that. He knows I have a headache. He's seen me drink. And he knows what kind of a headache I have. But we have a little arrangement. I'll let you guess what that is. And so I'm forgiven for all of that. And there's a college kid, a little gal, who's staying, going to the University of Miami, and she had one of those big advertising things that said, they are aspirin, and it was, they're using them in drugstores, and they're full of I don't know what. And but it looks like Bayer aspirin. And I ran out of Bayer aspirin one morning on my way to work, so I dashed into her room to get one of those Bayer aspirin that was in that big bottle. I figured if one would do, two would be better. And I took two of those little Bayer aspirin things, and I go into my bedroom to finish getting dressed, and she came rushing in, and she said, Lou, did you take two of those aspirin? And I said, yes, I did, just have a terrible headache. She said, Lou, those are not aspirin. Those were diet pills, those really heavy, heavy things that, you know, I went out that night, I went to work that day, went out that night, didn't get home till 7 o'clock in the morning, had to change clothes, go to work, I was just feeling good. What the heck is that? I don't know that stuff, didn't even have a hangover. So I said to her, where do you get that stuff? She said, my father's pharmacist. Oh, well, I said, get me some of that. So she got me some of that. And it's wonderful stuff, you know, just great stuff. I never had hangover, stayed out half the night, went to work, was attacked. And one of my bosses said to me, he said, we drink at cocktail hour. I know you go out and stay out half the night. You come to work just all shiny and nice. He said, what are you doing? I said, would you like to feel that way? He said, I'd love to feel that way. So I got him some. And we both felt good every morning, you know, it was just terrific. And I have now met what's going to be my second husband, who's a pilot. And I meet my second husband, and we're on our way to California. And he said to me one morning, we'd stop early in the afternoon to get the cocktail hour going. And he said to me, you know, Marie, I don't understand it. We drink ourselves blind at night, and you get up in the morning, and you're just feeling terrific, and you drive all day because I'm too sick to drive. He said, I don't understand that. And I said, would you like to feel like I do? He said, I'd love to feel like you do. So I reached in my purse for my supplies to come to California because I didn't know anybody in California. And I showed him what it was. And he looked at that and he said, Marie, do you know what that is habit forming? I said, get out of here. He rolled down the window and threw it out of the window. There went my supplies. I could have killed him. I just could have killed that guy. And we drove out here, and then I had the hangovers, and he got to do some of the driving. When we got out to California, fortunately, I never bought another one of those again. But I got out here, and I got my big job again in the insurance business. And in 1952, we got here in 54, get it back up a minute. In 1952, I got a letter from my father. He said, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, good. Good. I hope they kill you. I had read that Jack Alexander article in 1941. And I knew my father needed it. I didn't know I did, but I knew he needed it. And in 1948 or 49, there were some people that bought a restaurant in my neighborhood in Coral Gables. And I went down there to meet them because they were new in the neighborhood. And there was a little lady, the wife of the man that was there. She was sitting at the counter. She's about my size. And so I introduced myself. She introduced herself. And her husband said, honey, it's 8 o'clock. You better go to your meeting. And I assumed it was a PTA meeting because I had a 16-year-old daughter. And so she went on to the PTA meeting, I thought. And a few weeks later, I came home from work one day and ladies in the house said, Marie, Dolly got drunk and threw a brick through the window. I said, oh no, they don't drink. You must be mistaken. They had invited me to their home for dinner one night and they didn't serve any booze and I didn't go back. Oh, go back, they don't serve booze. So I went down to the restaurant, see the big hole in the window. Sure enough, big hole in the window. And I said to the husband, what happened here? He said, Dolly got drunk and threw a brick through the window. I said, she always does. And he said, I know you think they're PTA meetings, but they aren't. They're Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I said, where is she now? He said, she's in the hospital. I said, do you mean she just drank today and she's in the hospital? He said, that's right. I said, she's sick. He said, yeah, she's sick, all right. I said, can I talk to her when she gets out? And he said, sure. So when Dory got out of the hospital a couple of days later, I said, tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, you know, my father's a drunk. And I think he needs this program. I don't need it, you understand. My father needs it. She understood. Now this time I had liked the looks of her husband quite well. And I hope she'd go back in the hospital again. She did. And the next thing I know, she's chasing me around town with a gun, going to kill me. And she never was a very good shot, so she missed me. I've been shot at and hit and shot at and missed several times. I don't like guns. Never have. And you know, I watched that lady drink up a fortune. I watched her drink up herself. And I felt sorry for her. Never did I realize that I would be like that lady. And that husband of hers was in my life, in and out of it, for 29 years. And she died of cancer. And you know, before she died of cancer, I got my chance to make amends to this lady. She was speaking at a meeting, the second meeting that I went to in Long Beach. She was speaking at an afternoon meeting. And the leader of the meeting said to me, Marie, do you know of Dory Kay? I said, I sure do. He said, well, if you see her, tell her to get up here on the podium. She's blue. And I said, I will. And she came down the aisle and she had her sponsor with her and they got up and she talked. And so I thought, boy, here's my chance to make amends to this lady for having fun with her husband. And after the meeting, I went up to her, and of course, we had our name tags on, and my last name was different now. And I went up to her, and I said, Dory, perhaps you don't remember me. I'm Marie K now, but I used to be Marie M, and then Marie B. And she said, ah, you're familiar. Your face is familiar. Yes, I think I know you. And I said, I'd like an opportunity sometime to talk to you. She said, that's fine. And the next thing out of my mouth was, will Lou be here tonight? She said, yes, she's speaking at the Saturday night meeting. I said, I'll be looking forward to seeing him. And I talked to some people on my way to the ladies' room. I have a 42-minute kidney. And I went to the ladies' room, and she was standing there with her back to the door, and her sponsor was facing me. And I heard these words out of her mouth. I recognized that bitch the minute I saw her. And her sponsor was going like that. And I just passed on by and I went to the ladies' room. And I thought, so that's the way you feel about me when I'm going to make amends to you. Oh, it's 6 o'clock. And so the Saturday night meeting, my current boyfriend was with me at the time, and I went into the hospitality room and waited for him to appear. And he appeared, and she was next to him, real close. And I went up, and I said, hi, Lou, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. And we chatted for a moment. And then the meeting started, and he went up and told his story, which I knew quite well. I was a part of it. He didn't mention my name, thank God. And you know, I was so upset because I couldn't make my amends to this miserable broad. I didn't care if she ever got sober, the way I felt about it. And on Sunday morning, he asked me if I would speak at their meeting in Santa Barbara. And I said, I certainly would. I'd like to do that. Will you speak at mine in Burbank? Oh, I'll be happy to do that. I said, I'll tell you when I have an opening, and you tell me when you have an opening. And so I got home, and I found an opening, and I wrote a letter to his home. And I didn't get an answer. So I thought, well, I need an answer. I think I'll call him. I'll call his business number. And I called his business number. And he answered the phone, and I said, I sent you an invitation to speak at my meeting, and I haven't had a reply. He said, that's all right. I haven't seen the invitation. I said, uh-huh. Tell me, where did you go to this area very often? As a matter of fact, yes, I'll be there next week. I said, good. I'll see you then. And I thought, that'll teach her not to let me make an amend. Now I'm sober. I'm not supposed to do that. You know that. I'm not supposed to do that. My life has been like that. It isn't anymore. I'm warm and wonderful now. I want you to know that. Your husbands are entirely safe with me. I am not in the market. But that's what I was like. That is what I was like. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's so funny, they tell you this really misinformation. What they said to me is, don't get emotionally involved in the first year. I thought, piece of cake. I hate men, I hate women. You don't get emotionally involved that way. And you know, I didn't. I did not get emotionally involved. And a week before my first birthday, I started laying my plans and vice versa. And you know who I'm going to pick, don't you? I'm going to pick the secretary of the group. I don't want that small stuff. I want some big stuff. And that's what I started to do. And you know, I had to stop that. I had to think about that. And I had to stop it. I had to start to change my ways. I have to start somewhere. I have to stop doing those things. Because now I am uncomfortable doing those things. Not that I stopped right away, but I recognized the fact. And I started doing better. I had a lady sponsor at that time, my drinking buddy's wife. And she was not the sponsor I should have had, but she was my first sponsor. And I was doing inventory, or trying to do my inventory. Excuse me. I just laid out in the big book. And I was having very great difficulty. And she said to me one night at a ladies' meeting, she said, how are you doing with your inventory? I said, I'm having great difficulty with parts of my inventory. She said, what parts is that? And I said, well, you know, you're making those lists and things. And I said, I can't seem to I can find a lot of bad things about me, but I can't seem to find any good things about me. She said, really? She said, would you like me to help you in that area? I said, yeah, would you mind? And she said, well, let me give you just three or four things that you can start with. She said, you're very good at your job. I said, oh, yeah, yeah. She said, you dress well. I said, yeah, I know that. She said, you meet friends. She said, yeah, I know that. She said, my, we're looking for the big things, aren't we? Like the second coming of the Virgin Mary. And I thought, well, you miserable witch. I was mad at her. Damn sponsor. I'm going to get me another sponsor is what I'm going to do. And I didn't right away. But I got my eye on one. I'm not supposed to have a man sponsor. But I got my eye on a man sponsor. And I'll tell you why I got my eye on that man sponsor. I rationalized to do what I want to do. He was a very spiritual, religious type of person, not my religion, a different religion. But he was very close to his church. And I thought, I'll get him for a sponsor. So I got him for a sponsor. I didn't tell him right away. I had him for a sponsor for 3 years before I told him what he was. And I would get mad at my home group, and he would take me to another meeting. He'd say, how do you like this group compared to the Burbank group? And I'd find fault with it. He made me go to the North Hollywood group on Radford. Every time there was a Monday holiday, with several requirements. I do not like North Hollywood. I do not like the Radford meeting. But I had to go there and practice my powers. I was not allowed to say a word. I was not allowed to cast an opinion. I was just allowed to listen and keep my mouth shut. God, that's hard to do. Well, you have as many opinions as I have. That's very difficult. Very difficult, you know. And, I taught me a lesson. I was able to keep my mouth shut. I didn't say anything. I was very good at that. And, it taught me a lesson. I can still go to Radford now. I can still think. I don't talk. I can still think about my opinion. But it took me a lot of different meetings. We went to Clancy's meeting. I had some opinions on that, too. And I wasn't allowed to express them. Even to Clancy, I was dying to express them to him. I was learning some lessons. I was getting better. You know, and I had that sponsor for 10 years. He was a good sponsor for me. I had that big secret in my life that he was that guy that told me there were no new sins. I hadn't put that down on anything. I hadn't told anybody. And so I thought, I'm going to tell this sponsor because he will understand. He's very religious and he will understand what happened here. So I took him to my apartment. I got him all set up. You sit on the couch over there. It was a sectional couch. And I'll sit over here at this little table, and then I will tell you my big secret. So he sat there, and I chatted a minute about other things that were bothering me. And then I said, now I'm going to tell you this big secret that has been bothering me. It's driving me crazy because it happened many, many years ago, 25 years ago in South America. And I told him my big secret about the chaplain. And I thought he was being very sympathetic. He had his hand up to his face, and I thought, see, he's shedding a tear. And what the SOB was doing was laughing, and he was trying not to show it. And I leaped up off from that chair I was sitting in. I landed on him, and the sectional went apart, and he went right down on the floor. And I said, it serves you right. I tell you a big thing like that, and you're laughing. And he couldn't stop laughing. He just couldn't quit. He was just... And the next thing I knew, I found myself laughing. That big secret that I'd been carrying all those years was now gone. It was now gone. I didn't have to carry it. I had no more secrets. Is that a relief? I hope to tell you that's a relief. A big relief. You know, my father got sober in 1952. And when I was 14 months sober, I got a call from my father. And he said, I'm dying of cancer. You've got to come home and see me. And I said, I can't. And I slammed up the receiver. And I went to my meeting. It was on 1717 Magnolia. And I went to the meeting and I was so upset. I knew I couldn't stay sober in Plattsburgh. And I ran into the meeting and our secretary at that time was Don Ash. And he was sleeping on the floor. At least I'd sleep on the floor then. Secretary was sleeping on the floor and I ran into the front door and he said, how are you? I said, fine. And he had looked at me. And he grabbed me by the arm and he said, no, you're not fine. I want you to sit down and talk to somebody. And so I said, I got to tell you something. And I told him that I just had a call from my father who had cancer and was terminal. And he said I had to go back to Plattsburgh and live and take care of my mother and him. And I said, I can't do that. He said, hush, hush, hush. I'm going to get you somebody to talk to. And he did. He got me someone else to talk to, and they calmed me down. And I was able to get on a plane and go back to visit my father when I was 14 months sober. And I was scared to death. I don't know anything about being sober in Plattsburgh, New York. Believe me, I don't. And my father has now been sober a long time. And I go into the house, and my father, I owe amends to my father. I owe tremendous amends to my father. And I walk in the house, and my father meets me at the door. And I got it all in my head, what I'm going to say to him and what I'm going to say to my little Al-Anon mother. And I walk in that door, and my father puts his arms around me, and I put my arms around him, and he said, I love you, honey. I said, I love you too, Dad. That's the only amend we had to make. We gathered up my little Al-Anon mother, and the three of us stood there with our arms around each other. That's the only amend I had to make to my father. He knew how I felt. He knew what I had done. And I knew what he had done. And I had 4.5 years with my father. Many times I would have to leave California, Burbank, and go back there to see him. And my father had 7 babies at the time. All Catholic priests. And I wouldn't let him answer the phone. I'll take care of this. You've been sober so long, you forgot what it's like. Then I'd get one of those Catholic priests on the line, tell him who I was. Now, my story is very well known on the East Coast, so I'll tell you. I was a great part of my father's story, as he is of mine. And my father would lay in bed just screaming, Marie, let me have the phone. No way, Jose, I'm handling this. I don't know if my father lost all 7 of them or not, but I know I never met any of them. So we didn't come to see their sponsor while I was there. You know, I had to learn about that, too. I have to learn my lessons. And you know, I was called back many times. I went to my dad's meeting in Plattsburgh. And there were some kids that I'd gone to school with, all sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. All sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting there one night. I'm doing it like we do it in Burbank, which is sure different. No, I'm not going to do it like we do it in Burbank, which is sure different. And out of the audience comes a voice that says, "Hey, Marie, why don't you lead a meeting like you do it in Burbank?" And I thought, Jesus, my father was there somewhere, you know, and I knew he wasn't. Some crazy sailor that had been to a meeting in Burbank and was now in Plattsburgh, New York. I don't know how he got there. It's an army town. But there was a sailor there who had been to a meeting in Burbank. It's a small world. It's a small world. I said, "No, honey, if I lead a meeting like you do in Burbank, they'll throw us out of here. They'll throw us out of here." I had some good experiences back in my father's home group. Because they would look at me and say, "She's the one? God, I remember we went to school together." And I'd look at them and I'd say, "He's been sober how long? I remember him." It's amazing when you go back. We were talking about it earlier in the day about seeing older people that you knew you went to school with. It's fantastic. And I'd come back to Burbank and tell them all the way they did it on the East Coast. And it wasn't nearly as good as it was in Burbank. Because Burbank is the sobriety capital of the world. I told them all that back in Burbank. And back in Plattsburgh. And you know, when I had those 4.5 years with my dad was one of the most hated men in the area until he got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. When my dad died, there were 300 people that came to the funeral. They came from all over. They came from Montreal, Canada. And they came from Connecticut and Massachusetts and New York City. They came from all over because they knew my dad. And they were all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was astonished. A man that everybody hated. And there they were at his funeral. It's fantastic what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you I have not been the most beloved person in the world. And now that I'm warm and wonderful, I expect always to be that way. And my temper is, well, I've had to work harder on my anger than all of the other things combined. And every once in a while I get a short fuse again. We just lost one of our members in Burbank of cancer. He was the secretary of our group at one time. His name is Bob Lonergan. He just died with cancer. And I remember when he was the secretary of our group, I do the candles in my group. I have been doing the candles for 28 years in my group. And he inadvertently turned the fan on one day when I'm doing the candles. And I came across that room with my fist out, ready to let him have it. Of course, I'd just gotten through telling everybody how warm and wonderful I was. And he flipped that thing off again and apologized, and I said, and went back and relit my candles again. And I said, "You get your case and turn the fan on and blowing out every one of the candles." I'm nice now. Just don't turn the fan on. Don't turn the fan on. I have lessons to learn still. When Don died and my sponsor, my main sponsor 10 years died, I had to get another sponsor. And I looked over the group, and I thought, I need somebody. I need somebody who is strong. And I picked an old Okie. She'd been sober since the Last Supper. So she's a Catholic. You know, they're not born Catholics, but they turn out to be Catholics, wherever the hell that is. She's one of them. And I thought, I think I will ask her to be my sponsor. I checked her out for a couple of years, I think. And then one day I asked her to be my sponsor. She said, "I've had my eye on you." Now, I can't fool that broad. No way. There is no way that I can fool her. No way at all. She's exactly what I need. Exactly what I need. She has what I want. In more ways than one. She just married a very rich man. He's not an alcoholic, but he's very rich. And he likes you a lot. When he told her, when she kicks the bucket, I'm next. And I said to her, when are you getting another cold? She has her faults. She's very jealous. But she's been very good to me. She has been what I need. I worked with other alcoholics. They told me I had to do that. The first time that I got a drunk, I got a call on a Saturday night. I had been sober about 10 or 11 months. And the lady called me on the phone. She said, Marie, there's a drunk lady sitting on the corner by your street. Go get her off the corner. I said, okay, I'll do that. Saturday night, I went there. Sure enough, there's a drunk lady sitting on a curb on the corner. And I said, are you a drunk lady? She said, yep, I'm a drunk lady. I said, I'm here to pick you up. And I picked her up. She was living with her son until her son had kicked her out. So I took her to my apartment, put her in my bed while I slept on the couch with a butcher knife under my pillow, just in case. And I took time off from work, and I took care of that old witch. She said she needed a drink. When she got to my apartment, she said she needed a drink. I called, well, my father told me if they say they need a drink, you better give them one because they may go into fits or something. So I said, all right, I'll get you a drink. And I called the liquor man, who knew I was sober and already sent me a card. And I said, Lou, I need a pint of vodka. She yelled out, no, a fifth. I said, no, I want a pint. He said, oh, no, my God, Marie, you didn't have a slip, did you? And I said, no, I got a drunk lady here. And he brought me a pint. And I spoon-fed that pint to her with what I had, that honey and vinegar, you know. Did you ever have that treatment? Well, you never get it. But I gave it her because that's what they gave to me. And I spoon-fed her. And then I told her she had to go back. She had to go out and get sober. And I don't know if she ever got sober or not. She came to my door one night. 3 o'clock in the morning, or 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. She came to my door, beating on my door. And I went to the door. I used to sleep in my birthday suit at that time. And I opened the door in my birthday suit. Thank God it was her and not a him. My birthday suit has wrinkles in it now. I don't do that anymore. But I asked her what the hell she was doing there. And she said, I'm drunk again. I said, I know it. She said, how can I get in a 12-step house? Or how can I get the cops to pick me up? Or what can I do? I said, you want the cops to pick you up? I said, go throw a brick through somebody's window. They'll pick you up. She did. She threw a brick through somebody's window and they'll pick her up. And I got to go back to work again. I've gotten to work with a lot of alcoholics. They haven't all been that way, fortunately. I get some nice ones who ask the same questions that I ask. I get some that are doing the same things that I did. And I give them the same answers that I got. What worked for me, I assume will work for them. Do they listen to me? Of course not. I don't get a call until we've already done something we weren't supposed to do. Like get emotionally involved in the first year. You know. What are you? You know, are you in love or in heat or what's your problem? You know, I know what their problem is. You know, and that's kind of the way it goes. I went through that. I know what that is. I remember somebody told me when I was new, or I had my year in, and I'm window shopping, and somebody told me that there was the worst man in the world, had been sober for a long time, and he hit on new people in AA. I think they said new young people in AA. I was young once, you know. And so I thought, I got to see that guy. See who that is. I saw that guy, 9 feet tall, and I thought, so that's it. What do they see? You know, he's an awful looking person. The first thing he did was step on me one time. He backed up and stepped on my foot. And I thought, I certainly wish I was carrying that hat pin I used to carry. I'd make you bend over, fella. And the next time that he ran over me was at another meeting one time, and he backed up and knocked me halfway across the room. And I thought, I'm going to get that guy. He came to a Burbank meeting one night. I didn't know he was there. My father, when I was a child, nicknamed me Cracker Ass. For very good reason, I don't have any. I'm flat. And I knew that when I grew up and moved away, nobody would ever know that that was what my father called me. And that night in my Burbank meeting, I'm walking across the floor and a voice says, "Hey, cracker ass." And it's that 9-foot-tall SOB. And I'm thinking, boy, you are in luck that I'm warm and wonderful now. Because I've got your number. And you know, I started to, I really wanted to get that guy. I didn't know what I wanted to do to him, but I knew I wanted to get him. There must be a way without breaking any of the rules. And come up for a date one night. Got another lesson to learn here, folks. Call me up for a date one night. He was going on a speaker to speak someplace, and he said, "I'd like to take you to dinner, and you can come with me." I said, "Fine, love to do that." And I went on out with him for dinner and whatnot, and he was telling about some problems he was having with his kids. He couldn't stay sober. And I said, "What happened? Did your wife get the kids in the divorce?" He said, "I'm not divorced." I thought, "Oh God, here I am doing it again, and it ain't even my fault." I said, "The man was married. Still married, still is." I met his wife at a meeting in Honolulu a few years ago. Not a diamond either. She doesn't like alcoholic women. I don't blame her. I don't blame her. I had another lesson to learn. If they don't tell you, you don't know. You know? You don't know. I'm so glad that my lessons are those that are so acute, I can't forget it. I was at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Old Chrissy Walker was talking. She's dead now. And he always used to talk to the new people in the front row. He's talking one night and he said, "Kids, I got news for you." And I thought, big deal coming. "There are no new sins." I've never heard that before. I heard that on Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro from a Catholic chaplain. Here it's coming out of the mouth of a sober alcoholic. Long time. I met another movie in Burbank, Alcoholics Anonymous. And Leanne is talking. And Leanne is going on with her talk, and she comes to the end of the, toward the end of her talk, and I'm very interested in what she's going to say, and she throws another one of those old things at me. What the hell was it? It went out of my head. I don't know what it was she said. I'll think of it in 5 minutes. But it was another one of those things that I'd heard 25 years ago out of the mouth of an alcoholic, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never know where the message is coming from. I always sit in the front row in my home group. One reason is I have to do candles, but the other reason is that I listen to the speaker, and I don't care who the speaker is. I don't care if they've been sober 2 years or 42 years, because I don't know where the message is coming from. Maybe it's going to come from some drunk that's standing out by the coffee bar. But maybe it's going to come from the podium. So I always listen. Somebody said to me one time, "Why don't you give up that chair?" They tried to steal my chair several times. She was a newcomer, you know. So get to the meeting early and we'll sit in Marie's chair and see what she does. They test me out. So I come in and I sit right beside them. "How do you like the meeting so far?" "We like it finally. How do you like it?" "I think it's great. This is the sobriety capital of the world. This is my home group. Hope you'll stay with us." And I just sit next to them. Nothing happens. The next night they try again. And I sit next to them. Ask them how they're doing. "How are you doing?" "Fine." The next night they say, "Oh, for God's sake, she's not even getting mad." And they move out of my seat. And I get it back again. And my healthy sponsor will say, "You know, if somebody took your seat away, you'd really be mad." "No, I wouldn't. I'd just sit next to them, ask them how they're feeling. I'd sit next to them, ask them how they're feeling. I would sit next to them and ask them how they're feeling, and then they knew. The other night, about a month ago, a young lady came to our group. I don't know who she was. She apparently got there very early, because she sat in my chair. And I went up to her, and I said, who are you? She said, my name is whatever it was. I said, new to this group, aren't you? She said, yes, I am. I heard it was the sobriety capital of the world. I said, that's what it is. I hope you'll stay with us. You'll like it here. I'm glad that you're sitting up front, because you can learn to listen. She said, yes, that's why I sit up front all the time where I'm from. I said, good. Glad you're with us. And I sat across the table from her. Everybody that came in said, who's sitting in your seat? I said, this is so-and-so. She's from wherever she was from. At the end of the meeting, she said, I'll never sit in your seat again, Ray. I said, that's all right. We all have to learn. Like I didn't, you know. You know, like I say, I never know where my lesson is coming from. I only know that it's coming from somebody. It'll be in this hall today. It was in this hall today. And it will be in this hall again tonight. And I look around, I have a lot of friends here. I have a lot of people who know me very well, who've known me ever since I've been sober. There's a young man who walked in here today, didn't know I was going to be here. I had a lesson to learn, and his wife had a lesson to learn. One day, Ron was secretary of our group at that time, and his wife, Sherry, was still with us then, and she said to Ron one time, Ron, why is it that me and I get along so well? We just get along so good. Why is that? He said, because you're both snobs. Really? I never thought of that. And that's what I am. I'm a snob, I guess. I didn't know it. I try not to be. But Ron had to pull my covers then, and Sherry had to tell me about it. I don't know unless you tell me. If I'm doing something wrong, I know you will tell me. There's a lady sitting down there that gave me a lesson yesterday. I was a little teed off there for a minute or two. And then she told me how long she'd been sober. And I thought, isn't that just like them? They've been sober longer than you have, and I've got to tell you about it. It's incredible. It happens all the time. I don't know how many times I do it to people. They don't usually tell me, because they know about me and my hat pin, which I don't carry anymore. But you know, I have come to find out, they talked about a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, and I really didn't know what that was at the time. And when we had that severe earthquake in 1971, I had a real spiritual experience. And you know, the only thing I remember saying is, dear God, I thought my mother would die before I did. And I jumped out of the bed, and I tried to crawl under the bed, and my two cats were already there. And there wasn't any room for me. And I went out in the kitchen, and I do what I do when I get upset and I get nervous. I put the coffee water on, I do this, and I do that, and I get dressed, and I go to work. I went up to my office, I stopped at Patty's, and I had a cup of coffee, and everybody's talking about the earthquake. And I'm not talking about anything, I'm just sitting there like this. And I went in, and I went into my office, and I was always there early. I'm retired now, but I was always there early. And the phone rings, and it's my boss, and he said, what are you doing there? I said, what do you think I'm doing here? I'm working. He said, my God, man, we just had an earthquake. I said, are you trying to tell me something? I don't know, but I'm here working. Where are you? He said, Ray, go home. Go home. We're not going to work today. I said, oh, okay, I'll go home. I don't want to, but I'll go home. And I did. I closed the office up again, and I went home. That's the way I react. This morning, when I had my accident and my denture broke, or at lunchtime, rather. Fortunately, I was with some people that had happened to. I got so scared, I got so frightened, I want to run home. I don't want to have to talk here today. I just want to get the hell out of here and go home, because I'm afraid. I'm afraid it's going to happen again. And I'm afraid I'll lose my dignity. I'm afraid something will happen. And I have somebody with me who's very strong. And somebody else who knows what happened, and they went around and found a gal who works in this kind of stuff all the time. And she will take care of me later on today. It always happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It always happens. That little angel, they give me one of those little angel things that sits on your shoulder. I had real ones today. Real angels today in Alcoholics Anonymous. It always happens. It always happens. I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous all over the place. I've been to the convention in Honolulu 9 times. Can't afford to go anymore, but I loved it. Keith used to be there, too. You know, I have a baby that lives in Honolulu. I keep babies every place where I want to go. You can keep them all over the country. Why, you know. I went back to Florida, my old drinking ground, in 1978. I went first back in 71, but I went back again in 78. In 71, when I went back, I spoke at a big meeting in Miami Beach. And there was that man again. There was that man again, and all these people that I saw that I used to know. You know, I've had different names and different identities. My first husband and one of my first collectors both had the last name of M. And it was so easy because even my underwear was monogrammed. And so the initials fit. And here I ran into some of these people in Florida again. And all you do is say, good evening. And you smile and you go on by. Because you're not sure the wife found out. You know? Every time you travel, you run into something like that. And it reminds me of that old self. The person I used to be. And the things that I don't do anymore. I am so at peace with myself. I have been treated like a lady for all of my life. Even when I didn't act like one. My sobriety has given me 1,000 gifts. It has taken away a lot of the anger. It has given me back a spirituality that is incredible. I was 19 years sober before they got me to go to a retreat. You think I'm going to go to a retreat? I am not going to go to a retreat. That's church. I'm not going to a retreat. Father Bill Wilson was the retreat master. First year he was there. My sponsor, that old Oki, she went in ahead of me, told him all about me. I know she did. Because when I walked in, she put my name down second. And I went in, I'm not going to tell this for anything. Catholic priest, my foot is to go to confession to those guys. So I walked in and he said, "Hey, Marie, I've heard a lot about you." And I thought that old Oki's been spouting her mouth off again at me. And I said, "You know, Father Bill, I never told her my big secret." He said, "God, don't tell her." He said, "She'd have a fit." And I thought, he knows my big secret. How does he know? Now I know how he knows. He told me his big secret. You know, now I know how he knows. Isn't that wonderful to be able to share that kind of stuff? He's a Catholic priest. I love him to death. He looks just like my grandfather. When he's conducting our retreat, I wander down the hill with my grandfather. I forget he's a Catholic priest that's leading the thing. Sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love him to death. Sometimes I call him Grandpa because I still think he's my grandfather. I ask him if he has any new secrets for me every year that I go. It's amazing the things that happen to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know my father looks down at me and says, "Good kid." I know he loves me as I loved him. And I want to say something to the newcomer, and I'm going to shut up. If you're new, some of you are, or relatively new, or if you're coming back, I wish you well. Thank you.